From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Election Day. On today's Fresh Air, we turn to one of our favorite pundits, satirist Harry Scheer. He'll give us his observations on the presidential campaign, and we'll eavesdrop on some imaginary private moments between Dick Morris and his mistress and Bob Dole and his handlers. Also, the abortion pill. We discuss the practical use of the drug RU486 with Dr. Elizabeth Newhall, who's conducted drug trials on it in her women's health clinic. Critic Milo Miles reviews the Best Of collection by the now-defunct British folk band The Barely Works. And commentator Gerald Early wonders how his life would have been different had he gone to a black college. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Bob Dole will cast his vote today in his birthplace of Russell, Kansas, before returning to his home in Washington, D.C. Election Day culminates his marathon campaign tour, which included 29 stops in 20 states. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole is winding his journey down today, casting his vote in Russell, Kansas, where he's returned over the years to announce his candidacy and at times to accept defeats. Last night, after a 96-hour marathon push, a 10,000-mile trip that taxed Dole's voice, he mustered the strength to give a rousing speech at a rally at 3 in the morning in the hometown of come-from-behind candidate Harry Truman.
What was true for Harry Truman in 1948 will be true for Bob Dole and Jack Kemp in 1996, the people are once again going to win this election today.
In Independence, Missouri, Dole predicted he would win the election in a surprise upset that would defy the odds and challenge the prevailing wisdom. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Kansas City.
President Clinton votes today in Little Rock, Arkansas. He'll wait there to hear the results from balloting on Election Day. He's scheduled to appear at Little Rock's old statehouse late tonight. It's the same place where he announced his candidacy and where he appeared after learning he'd won the presidential election in 1992. Reform Party presidential candidate Ross Perot is urging citizens to vote their consciences today. The Texas billionaire drove himself and his daughter to their polling station in Dallas. Perot has done very little campaigning. He spent the last few days before the election preparing 4 half-hour-long infomercials supporting his candidacy. Colorado voters are deciding whether to adopt the Parental Rights Initiative. Proponents say it will allow parents to direct and control the education and values of their children. From Denver, NPR's Mark Roberts reports.
Supporters insist the so-called Parental Rights Amendment would give parents the authority to make public schools more accountable. They argue it would give parents a chance to oversee academic standards and see to it that values taught at home are the same values taught in the schools. Supporters include the Christian Coalition and the Reverend James Dobson, head of a Christian group called Focus on the Family. But opponents of the initiative, such as the Colorado Education Association and the state PTA, argue the initiative would open the door to lawsuits against teachers, school nurses, doctors, anyone who works with children that a parent might disagree with. They also fear the amendment could allow parents to define what they mean by corporal punishment and possibly get away with child abuse. Polls show voters almost equally divided. I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 49 points at 6,090. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 9.5 points at 1230. This is NPR. A spokesman for Russian President Boris Yeltsin says the Russian leader has regained consciousness. Doctors have completed Yeltsin's heart bypass surgery. They say it was a success. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Yeltsin's bypass surgery lasted about 7 hours and was performed by an all-Russian team. American cardiologist Michael DeBakey observed the operation and told reporters afterwards it was a complete success. I would predict the president to be able to return to his office and perform his duty in perfectly normal fashion, said DeBakey. Lead surgeon Dr. Renat Okchurin said there had been no unexpected problems. Before the surgery, Yeltsin made Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin the acting president, turning over all of his powers, including control of Russia's nuclear weapons. If no complications arise, Yeltsin faces a recovery period of up to 2 months, but doctors say he could begin working well before that. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
Hundreds of thousands of Russians have been marching in a one-day strike. The workers include teachers, miners, and defense workers. They're protesting unpaid wages and a shortage of jobs. The workers are owed an estimated $7 billion in wages and social benefits. More than 10,000 people in Moscow alone marched to Red Square today. Some carried signs that read, "Give us our money back." Unions hope their protest will give them leverage in their three-way talks with the government and employers, which are to resume tomorrow. The U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia has a new warning for Americans in the kingdom. The embassy says they could face terror attacks after today's presidential election and an upcoming bombing anniversary. November 13th is the first anniversary of a car bombing that killed 5 Americans and 2 Indians. The attack was on a U.S.-run military facility in Riyadh. Another bombing last June killed 19 American servicemen at a U.S. military housing complex in Dhahran. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. This election day, we sought out one of America's most thoughtful, cogent, and distinguished political philosophers to place the 96th presidential campaign in the proper perspective. Harry Scheer is the host of Le Show, a nationally syndicated radio program of political satire and social commentary. He's perhaps best known to television audiences as the voice of many of the characters on The Simpsons. Scheer also reports weekly on the O.J. Simpson civil trial for Slate magazine. I asked him if he thought there was one burning issue in this presidential campaign that the public hasn't picked up on.
I think Ross Perot made it burn, and it's the issue of campaign finance reform. It's the issue that drives the public cynicism about everything else. If you, as a member of the public, really feel that the politics is bought and paid for by people who don't have your interests at heart, then apathy follows as night the day. The issue of really remarkable amounts of money. We may have ended up spending $1.2 billion, and by we I mean they, on this campaign, and if the pundits are right, nothing will have changed. Clinton will be president. The Republicans will control Congress. That $1.2 billion could have bought a lot of other stuff. It put some money in the economy. The guys who wrote the scary music behind the TV commercials are doing well, I suppose. But that's an amazing expenditure of money. Even if things changed, the fact that perhaps nothing will change makes it a stupefying amount of money. That issue, I think, will continue to burn and perhaps will be more in the public's mind after the election than before, because unless you seriously considered voting for Ross Perot, that issue did not really connect to a vote for either of the two major party candidates since they were both at the trough.
Well, on the topic of campaign fundraising, the Democratic National Committee fundraiser John Wong has been at the center of at least Republican attacks over foreign contributions to the Democrats, and he's brought in significant contributions from contacts in Indonesia and Southeast Asia.
Your Buddhist temple in suburban Los Angeles.
Right, you can spread it around.
Yeah.
What do you make of the John Wong debacle?
It's a new example of an old law, I guess, which is reforms always go bad. What John Wong was doing was collecting soft money, which was a little loophole that was allowed in the post-Watergate reforms. And, 20 years later, giant Mack trucks, giant barges are rolling through that loophole filled with money. There's an impulse in America. We certainly feel it here in California more than anywhere else because the progressives were in control in California for a long time, of trying to clean up politics. And there's an extent to which you can do it, I suppose, and there's an extent to which you have to kind of leave it alone because the more you try to clean it up, the dirtier it gets.
I'd like to have you take us back to the conventions because I understand that you watched every unedited satellite feed network on cable and local coverage. Although the rest of us didn't watch the whole Clinton train ride hour after hour, as I imagine you did, what's mm-hmm. the cumulative effect of watching Bill Clinton making the same speech over and over, and I imagine doing the same shtick over and over?
Yeah, it's... It's demoralizing. I mean, it puts you in the position that most political reporters are in when they ride along, and makes you understand when a politician complains about negative media. When you see the same speech and the same shtick, you kind of are watching for anything new, and anything new seems to be usually a mistake, a fumble, something that goes wrong.
You noticed at almost every stop that Clinton would pick out an elderly member of the crowd and call for a doctor to make sure that they were surviving the heat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, this was midsummer, remember, and these rallies were in the sunshine, and he'd always, you know, scan the crowd till he'd see somebody. I think we need a doctor over there. And it was an important moment to me because we had gone in the space of 3 years from a proposal to totally rejigger the national healthcare system and set up these 50-state alliances and managed competition and so forth to a healthcare system that basically calls for the President of the United States spotting you in the crowd and personally calling for CPR for you.
Grassroots.
Grassroots, yeah.
Healthcare.
Hands on. Well, you know, the whole change in Clinton's attitude and outlook has been to minimize government and, you know, come up with all these small programs. So he'll come on and lay hands on each and every one of you, apparently, is the premise in the next 4 years.
Well, speaking of laying on of hands, the Dick Morris scandal broke during the Democratic National Convention.
Seems far away now, doesn't it?
It does, but I do appreciate the fantasy serenade that you came up with.
Well, you know, the funniest thing about the Dick Morris episode to me was the premise that he was having these trysts with this prostitute and not only and showing her speech drafts of the president's speeches and nightly tracking polls and asking her what she thought. And it just seemed to me like this was either totally a fantasy in the mind of the prostitute, or she just got turned on in an unusual way.
Anything's possible, I guess.
Anything's possible in this world. Yeah.
Let's listen to your fantasy serenade to Dick Morris by his mistress. This is from Harry Shearer's Le Show.
You can suck my stockings, dear. You can worship at my feet. Every nail will be a thrill, every toe a treat. You'll have everything you need to make your life complete. Groups, graphs to plot. They turn me on, they make me hot. Read me polling numbers.
That's Harry Shearer's rendition of a serenade on the part of Dick Morris's mistress. It aired on his nationally syndicated radio program, Le Show. Now, how much do you think character was ever an issue with the American electorate in this election, or really any in the last four?
Well, it wasn't an issue in 1972 when we reelected Richard Nixon by a landslide. I think we've been misled a little bit into thinking how important it is by the thrill of catching Gary Hart on the monkey business. And the premise that Bob Dole was trying to sell in the waning days of his campaign, that our presidents have been or should be Boy Scouts, kind of pales when you look at the record. I mean, Ike had a mistress, Roosevelt had a mistress, Kennedy slept with half of Hollywood. You know, I think, if anything, the country in those days was protected from the knowledge. There was a moment of shock when we had the knowledge shared with us in the Gary Hart days, and we may now be growing into the what I like to call the French phase of, you know, we expect them to have a mistress as long as they don't screw up their job.
We just expect everyone to be discreet.
Well, you know, it is a fact of life that the guys who get into that business have too much testosterone, and they got to do something with it.
This is your scientific theory of power?
It has been noted by those with more degrees than me.
Harry Shearer is my guest. He has a nationally syndicated radio program called Le Show. He's performed many of the voices on the TV series The Simpsons. Harry Shearer is also writing commentary on the O.J. Simpson civil trial for Slate magazine. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harry Shearer, the host of the syndicated radio program, Le Show. Now, what do you make of Dole's 96-hour campaigning marathon? I think most people's reaction was they were just afraid for his health.
Yeah, I thought originally it was, a suicide move. You know, you're not going to vote for me? Well, vote for my corpse. He does seem to be weathering it pretty good up to the time that we're having this conversation, although his voice is going out. But the strangest thing to me is I'm watching it because I'm seeing almost every appearance he makes, is it seems to have triggered some sartorial change in Bob Dole's approach. He comes out wearing the strangest variety of windbreakers. Remember when he first quit the Senate, he said he was going to be Citizen Dole, and he actually went to the trouble of changing clothes on the plane from Washington to his first appearance in Chicago, so he wouldn't be in his blue suit and tie. And if you know Bob Dole's physical circumstances, well, changing clothes on a plane anyway, assuming he didn't do it in full view of the passengers, means you're going to do it in that little bathroom. It's not an easy task, and Bob Dole's situation makes it even more daunting. So you have to at least give him credit for a lot of pluck. And I think that's what he's trying to prove with this 96 hours, you know. Yeah, I'm 73. Yeah, a lot of pluck. But the white puffy windbreaker look, I don't know who it was made for, but it wasn't made for Bob Dole. And it's late in the game to bring back the Citizen Dole look, especially since he wears the white puffy windbreaker with a tie. So it looks like he's a member of some, drill team that's lost its band.
You've pointed out that Bob Dole doesn't do too well on the stump with the slogan thing. For Le Show, you produced a recording session featuring Bob Dole as he and his handler try out some new slogans for his anti-drug platform. Let's listen to a bit of it. This is from Le Show.
This bud's just not for you. Are we against beer now?
No, sir. Bud is slang for pot.
Yeah. I always liked that slogan from the last time around. Why do you think they call it pot?
Yes, sir, but remember, we like the just don't angle as building on the Nancy Reagan platform.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Just don't have it your way.
That's my favorite. It sounds so tough.
Yeah, tough but fair.
Mm.
Okay, here goes. A mind is a terrible thing. Just don't waste it.
You know, that has a good flow. But I wonder if it's really clear.
Got Quail in trouble talking like that. Just don't bring good things to life. I don't know what that one means.
It's building on the platform of the GE slogan.
Mm.
We thought it sent a nice coded message to the Christian Coalition, you know, getting the word life into it. Keep going.
Yeah, how about this one? A little dab just won't do you. It's like that Brill Cream commercial.
That's Harry Shearer from a skit on his nationally syndicated radio program, Le Show. Where do you think the fault lies? With Dole's handlers? Or is it that Dole won't or can't convincingly do what they advise him to do or what they tell him to say?
I think what we're watching in Bob Dole is sort of what the country had with Lyndon Johnson last time, a guy who was basically a creature of the Senate, got into a position to be president of the United States, which is, you know, everybody kept saying, I know how he looks on TV, but one-on-one, he's really good. They're just two totally different sets of skills, you know, and he'd honed his, as Johnson had, through 35 years of, you know, getting with a guy in a room and saying, all right, what is it you need? What is it you need? Because we can do it. And that's where Dole, if there be magic in Bob Dole, I think that's where it was. And that's a very different thing from getting up in front of hundreds or thousands or millions of people and saying something that's striking, if not new or innovative, but that sounds bold, at least until you think about it, which is presidential skill, at least in 1996. And also, you know, as a legislator, you're always trying to split the difference. And as a president, you're supposed to make the difference. And I think that he never got the hang of the other job. He's running for president because it's the top of his profession, not because it's something he ever really had the skills for.
Is that why he sounds much less comfortable than other politicians using his name as in the third person, speaking of himself as the third person?
Well, you know, I think the next Republican presidential nominee should be a guy who's comfortable saying the word I. Remember, George Bush had real trouble. He just would say these sentences that didn't have any personal pronouns in them at all. Getting up every day, working on problems, solving them, tackling the big things. Never, you know, because his mom had taught him at an early age, don't say I. And now Bob Dole feels the same discomfort and deals with it by, Bob Dole going to do that. So I think, you know, before finding out how they stand on abortion or affirmative action or balancing the budget or any of these so-called issues, they should just determine that the next nominee feels comfortable calling himself I, because it will solve a lot of problems in the long run.
I can't let you go without talking a little bit about the O.J. Simpson civil trial. You've been attending it now since the beginning. How would you stack up the two, I guess you could say, parallel media circuses, the press coverage of the election and the press coverage of O.J.?
Well, gee, the press coverage of the civil trial is, you know, rumors and whispers, because this is something that was part of the fiber of everyday life for millions and millions of people the first time around, and this time it's being held in a closed courtroom. So every day you get maybe just the tip of the iceberg of what's going on in there, whereas I think in the political campaign we're getting the iceberg and the ice-making machine. I think people, you know, would be wishing for more tip, less iceberg in the campaign coverage, because it just seems to, as I say, I think if by Election Day we can't all recite both guys' speeches along with them, we shouldn't be voting.
Well, do you think the media coverage of this election is any worse than usual? And it gets back to this question, if there's no substance in the stump, substance in the political discourse,
well,
what's the media supposed to cover?
Yeah, I think the fact of the matter, the sad or happy fact of the matter, is that in any part of journalism, the people who are on the reporting side like to think that they think the way the people they're covering think. That is to say, the people who cover politics like to think the way the smartest people in politics think, and they think those people are the political operatives. So they like to read the polls because they know that, you know, Ed Rollins is reading polls. They like to concentrate on the horse race because they know that that's what Dick Morris is doing at night. So the coverage tends to have that particular slant, I think, more than any other. And similarly, in the O.J. trial, you know, we're all sitting around trying to think like lawyers. So, because those are the people who are running the show. So I think journalism just tends to have a bias towards the behind-the-scenes people who are crafting the spectacle.
I'm curious what your rituals, if you have any, are on this election day.
Frequent and long washings, I think, would be what I recommend, if not engaging. Now, on election day, because I have this this technology at my fingertips, I like to watch the plethora of rallies, sad and happy around the country, and try to figure out, just by watching the bands playing before the candidates arrive, which are the winning sides and which are the losing sides, you know, by the choice of songs and by the willingness of people to get up, dance, drink, or just sort of sit at their tables in these rented hotel ballrooms looking like, God, I wish I'd sent out my resume a month earlier. So that's what I'll be spending most of the evening doing.
Well, you're always one to appreciate a cliche. You know the one, be careful what you wish for, you might get it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can reflect on that as regards our two candidates and the American electorate, what we'll expect if either one wins.
Well, if Bob Dole wins, I think what we can expect is the most tanned president in our nation's history, because he's going to spend the transition period down at Bal Harbour with the aluminum reflector on his face as the advisors gather around him. I think we can also expect, some of the familiar faces from the Bush era back, and major fights about abortion, because there will probably be a Republican Congress as well. And that may be an issue that, though rarely mentioned aloud in this campaign, comes to dominate a lot of the discourse. If Clinton is reelected, I'm going to pull up a comfortable chair, set up some beverages, make sure the TV screen is washed and cleaned and de-dusted, because there are going to be some fine, fine hearings coming up, and I want to watch all of them.
Thanks a lot for musing.
My pleasure.
Harry Shear, host of the radio program Le Show. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The FDA has given conditional approval of the drug RU486, the abortion pill. Coming up, we'll talk with Dr. Elizabeth Newhall, who conducted drug trials of the pill in her Oregon clinic. Also, Myla Miles tells us about the Best Of collection by the British folk band The Barely Works. And commentator Gerald Early explores the pros and cons of education at a black college. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Music critic Milo Miles is a fan of the odd English folk band, The Barely Works. The group was together for 5 years, from 1988 to 1993. The seven-member band included accordion, fiddle, hammered dulcimer, and a horn section. Here's Milo's review of a new collection called The Best of The Barely Works.
The official line on the beginning of The Barely Works is that musician Matt Fox became fixated on the hammered dulcimer and formed a band so he could play the instrument in it. A typically whimsical tale for The Barely Works. It's a good name for a group that included, in addition to Fox, Allison Jones on fiddle, Keith Moore on tuba, Sarah Allen on accordion and flute, Richard Avison on trombone, Chris Thompson on banjo, and Tim Walmsley on drums. Why does this unlikely mix of instruments work even barely? I say it's because they formed in a rhythm-rich period. The Barely Works are another folk outfit invigorated by modern dance beats, particularly reggae and ska. Barely Works also beguile the ear with sheer simultaneous variety of sound. If the bluegrassy fiddle gets to be too much, there's always the Dixieland trombone to cut through, or the crazed Irish whistle for contrast. They all play close attention to each other, so it's more like a square dance swirl than a tussle. The Barely Works are sprightly, not splashy. But they know they're weird. The lines that jump out of their version of Old Joe Clark are, "I don't give a damn about old Joe Clark, and I'll tell you the reason why. He blows his nose in an old cornbread and calls it chicken pie."
Well, I went down old Joe Clark's, get me a glass of gin. He pulled me up for whipping his horse and give me hell again. Walk Joe Clark, talk Joe Clark, goodbye Billy. Walk Joe Clark, talk Joe Clark, I'm gonna leave this town. All right. You, pump it up, pump it up. And I'll tell you the reason why. He blows his nose in old cornbread and calls it chicken pie.
Walk Joe Clark, talk Joe Clark, goodbye Billy Brown. Walk Joe Clark, talk Joe Clark, I'm gonna leave this old town.
The Barely Works put out 3 CDs in their lifespan from 1988 to 1993. Best of the Barely Works on Cooking Vinyl adds 3 live tracks and weeds out the redundancies and the experiments that were just too hairy. Even so, the group was probably incapable of a perfect album. The main flaw is the undistinguished vocals. Richard Avison in particular could use a blood transfusion when he puts down his trombone to sing. There's just enough oomph in the voices of Sarah Allen and principal songwriter Chris Thompson. Together they even wrote a credible political prisoner tale called Bread and Water. Thompson did spew the only dud song on the collection, namely Back to the Mountains, which features a beautiful wispy introduction that devolves into gushes about sunlight kissing flowers and wind blowing free. Aside from that, everything works for the Barely Works, and they earn this hearty benediction called Stand Together.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. He reviewed the best of the Barely Works on the English label Cooking Vinyl.
Look at what we got. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, time.
Pull our belts right in. Held on tight to that special thing.
Oh, time.
The abortion pill, RU486, has been used in Europe for nearly a decade. Just last month, the FDA gave the abortion drug, officially known in this country as mifepristone, conditional approval. It should be available, by prescription, to the American public early next year, although its release may be held up by a business dispute. Proponents of the abortion drug claim that it will revolutionize abortion for many women. Doctors will be able to offer the drug in the privacy of their offices, away from abortion facilities and anti-abortion protests. The procedure also permits women to have an abortion much earlier than surgical methods allow. Opponents of the method, however, are lined up on both sides of the abortion debate. Anti-abortion activists argue that RU486 makes it too easy for women to terminate a pregnancy. And abortion supporters question whether the drug is safe and truly less painful and less traumatic than its surgical counterpart. Elizabeth Newhall is an OBGYN in private practice and medical director of the Downtown Women's Center in Portland, Oregon. She's one of the physicians who conducted the Oregon portion of the RU486 drug trials. I asked her to describe what happens when a woman decides to take the abortion pill.
First, there is the regular counseling around a woman's decision and examination of her medical history and so forth to make sure that she's an appropriate candidate. Most women are, actually. Very few are excluded medically. And then she takes the RU46, or mifepristone, as we call it here. RU46 was the tag name given to it by Russo-Eucleff. And since it's really completely controlled in this country by the Population Council, we use the name mifepristone. So that happens on day one. And 36 hours later, 36 to 48, but as close to 36 as possible, the woman returns to the clinic and takes a second drug called misoprostol. RU46, or mifepristone, the first drug, is the one, is the anti-progesterone. Progesterone is the hormone that really supports pregnancy, pro as in support of gestation, progesterone. And RU46, mifepristone, see I do it too, is an anti-progesterone, and so it basically disconnects the hormonal support of the pregnancy. So 36 hours later, the woman returns. Most women don't feel much different during this period, although some women did comment on a sort of a not too describable sense of difference at some point during that 36 hours, not unpleasant, not bothersome, but just that something might have changed. And then they return usually in the morning, 36 hours later, for the misoprostol, which is a prostaglandin. Prostaglandins are the substance in our body that makes us feel so icky when we have our period sometimes. It makes you kind of nauseated, makes you sort of have loose bowels, makes your uterus cramp. What this does is makes your uterus start to and complete the expulsion of the products of conception. Mifepristone also has the effect of sort of softening the cervix and softening the uterus, so it really makes it easier for the misoprostol to work. And then our bodies expel the products of conception. And so the woman bleeds a bit heavier than a period, cramps a bit heavier than a period, and usually over the course of several hours passes something, can tell really when she passes something, although all you can really see is blood and blood clots, and then it's over. Most women bleed afterwards for a week, 2 weeks, some rare women even longer than that. And we usually confirm, in fact, we did confirm always with ultrasound that the process had completed itself.
And there are, though, I think 10% of these women do take longer than 4 hours or longer than their stay at the clinic or wherever they're given the pills to expel the fetus.
Right. Some women, I would say probably, and again, I'm absolutely guessing at the numbers because the actual numbers from our research trials are not yet available, but we completely expect them to be commensurate with the European data. I would say it's somewhere a little upwards of 50% actually expel in the first 4 hours and probably another 30% in the first 8 to 10 hours and then a smaller fraction over the 24. When you use it at 7 weeks since the last period, 5 weeks since conception and less, there's about a 98, percent success with complete emptying. It's when you get into the slightly higher gestational ages, 8 and 9 weeks, which we did our trial with, that you get a lower incidence of complete emptying.
When is it appropriate to use RU486? What week in the pregnancy is the cutoff point, and what week is the beginning?
Well, you know, that is one of the absolute beautiful advantages of this drug, is that you can use it so much earlier. A surgical abortion, the completeness is really verified by visual inspection of the products. Now, at 6 weeks, you can just barely discern, you know, a tiny little placenta about as big as your pinky fingernail. You can't actually see a fetus with your naked eye until pretty much into the 9th week after the last period, 7 weeks of conception. So RU46 you can use, basically from the time you know you're pregnant, you can use RU46. So for example, those women who are really, really sick at 4 weeks don't have to wait that 2 weeks until they can have a surgical abortion. Some places don't do surgical abortions until even seven weeks. So there is a significant interval in between the time you know you're pregnant, know what your decision is going to be, and you have to wait still for a surgical abortion. So women can access RU46 much earlier in the pregnancy. The last date for using it is probably 9 weeks after the last menstrual period. We had a significantly higher incidence of women needing to be followed up by surgical abortion or surgical D&C afterwards, which, when you consider the fact that in many counties in America, women have to drive 8-10 hours, to get a surgical abortion, even an 85% incidence of success is probably acceptable to those women, and a failure with RU46 is still more like a miscarriage, and presumably those women will be able to find D&C services more locally, I would imagine. So given that women have to drive so far in some areas, even at the higher gestational ages, it may prove to be something that they might want to consider.
I read a story, and I imagine I'm reading these stories because the media might make a lot of the more sensational results of using RU486. Mm-hmm. But I did read a story of a woman who had taken the drug, gone through both visits, and mm-hmm. Hadn't completed the abortion at the clinic, went home a couple days later, actually in the shower. She expelled the products of the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think she was far enough along that this stuff does not go down the drain, and she scooped it up. And the way that she recalled the story was that she said on one hand, it made her realize what exactly she had done, what was there. Mm-hmm. And at 9 weeks, I believe she was at 9 weeks, you can see limbs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes hands and feet.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you can see hands and feet at 9 weeks.
And on the other hand, though, it was very disturbing for her. In the end, I think she found she could take responsibility for what she had done because it seemed to her a natural process.
You know, two comments on that. Almost all women who elected this method did so because they felt it to be a more natural process. And at first, I didn't quite understand that, but as I followed the women through it, it became obvious what they meant, which is that, your uterus does the emptying, your body does it, that the drugs sort of initiate the reaction, but it's actually your body expelling your own uterus, expelling the contents of it. Many people, not just women, have a lot of charge around surgical procedures at all. Abortion, even though it's a very surgical abortion, even though it's very quick, takes about 1 minute. The idea of someone putting a cannula in your uterus is appropriately, distasteful to a number of women, particularly, I think, given the number of women in our culture who've been sexually abused or physically abused. A lot of women have a real hard time dealing with a need for gynecologic surgery. So a lot of women really preferred to, be more in charge of this process themselves. And as far as, seeing the products, I believe what I observed actually was, the fear around surgery oftentimes is so much that it distracts women from, sort of processing the abortion decision and the abortion itself. And with RU-46, because there wasn't this distraction of such huge fear around surgery, I mean, women bleed. Women are used to bleeding. Women know what cramps feel like. They know what periods feel like. A lot of women have had even spontaneous miscarriages or birth. You know, birth has a lot of bleeding. And so women were able to really be more, you know, mentally, emotionally present to the process. And it's extraordinarily rare for a woman to actually see the products. The situation you describe, of course, expelling the products onto a grate would be, you know, like the only way it might happen. A 9-week fetus is probably, an inch long, if it's in toto, and of course it would be with RU-46. Most women were okay with, you know, being awake to what they were doing. I mean, I believe that women, I know women know that the abortion decision is a moral, ethical one for them. And I think some women even appreciated sort of witnessing rather than having it, you know, sort of scurried away from them as though it was not, you know, tolerable for them to see or something. I think what we imagine in our heads is sometimes worse than what we actually see. Of course, it has arms and legs. I mean, it that's what you would expect. But it is a fetus, you know, it is an embryo, really, at that stage, still an embryo. And so it's part of the process. It's a real thing.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Newhall. She's an obstetrician gynecologist with a private practice in Portland, Oregon. She's also the medical director of the Downtown Women's Center in Portland, a woman's health center specializing in abortion services. The center tested RU-486, the abortion drug method, as part of a nationwide drug trial. The FDA is expected to give final approval for the use of RU-486 in this country soon. It could be available sometime next year. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Elizabeth Newhall is my guest. She conducted clinical trials in her women's health center for the abortion drug RU-486. People opposed to RU-486 argue that it makes abortion too easy to obtain and to undergo. I asked Dr. Newhall what her response is to that criticism.
The other side to that is, you know, women should be punished for making this decision and that they should have something uncomfortable and more dangerous as a punishment, which is how I see that argument. I have never seen a woman make this decision lightly. Any way you have an abortion, it's uncomfortable. And any way you have an abortion, it's a major life event and decision. Now, women are infinitely varied, as all humans are, and some women are more tormented, and some women are real clear about what the right decision is for them. I would say that abortion is about women choosing when and if to become mothers. It's not a casual decision. It's because women care so very much about mothering, honor mothering so significantly that they are careful about choosing the time.
There are arguments against the use of the drug or I think fear of the drug on both sides of the abortion debate. And one of them is that if the drug is readily and somewhat widely available, it is easier for it to fall into someone's hands, a teenager, for instance, who's in whatever trimester, second trimester, who can get a hold of some abortion pills and think, I just take these pills, it'll solve my problem.
Everyone is so worried that women can't be in charge of their health. I find that kind of astonishing. All doses of RU-46 in Europe and in the States have been witnessed. Everybody is afraid of that. There have been births that have occurred in women who have taken RU-46 and either, you know, very, very few, very, very few. And there have been very, very few anomalies, not higher than the background anomaly rate in regular pregnancy. So while we will not ever recommend women taking it, there have been many normal babies born to women who have taken mifepristone. In fact, there's a lot of literature on using mifepristone at the end of pregnancy to soften uteruses to make induction of labor easier. So any doctor, when this becomes available, you can't just prescribe it, send the woman off to the pharmacy. It'll be done more like, for example, intrauterine devices or the Norplant was, which was the doctor will order the medication, having verified and demonstrated their ability to handle whatever might come around it. The doctor will have to verify competence in some way, then obtain the drug into their office, and then will witness the women taking the drug and be responsible for them being observed for the requisite time afterwards. So no one will be picking this up at any pharmacy, at least in the beginning.
There's quite a bit of research in its early stages that indicates that RU486 might have medical uses unrelated to abortion. For instance, there's an interest in its effectiveness as a treatment for breast cancer, also other cancers. You mentioned one use, which would be to aid in late-term in labor.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about its other possible therapeutic uses and where we stand with that.
It has been studied for brain tumors. It is successfully has been used in brain malignancies. It has been successfully used. It has been studied in breast cancer. It has been studied for endometriosis and fibroids. You know, two of the most common gynecologic problems women suffer from, and appears that it will be very helpful in those conditions. So, you know, when progesterone and estrogen became medically available, I believe it was in the 60s, you know, it really did revolutionize healthcare for women in a profound way in offering birth control, menopausal replacement therapy. I mean, huge impact. Mifepristone, RU486, is an anti-progesterone. It's a whole new, exciting class of drugs. We've only just begun to glimmer the possibilities.
Elizabeth Newhall, I want to thank you for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Dr. Elizabeth Newhall is medical director of the Downtown Women's Center in Portland, Oregon. This is Fresh Air. Writer and teacher Gerald Early is working on a book about Fisk University, a black school in Nashville. He's moved there for the academic year. In the first of a series of occasional commentaries, Early talks about what this experience means to him.
When an editor at one of the major publishing houses approached me 4 years ago to write a book about a black college, I was intrigued, but unsure if I wanted to do it. I didn't know much about black colleges. I never attended one. I had never even set foot on the campus of one until I began coming to Fisk University to learn about the place as the subject for this book. A couple of my aunts had gone to Cheney State Teachers College in Pennsylvania. This was back in the very early 1960s. They commuted from South Philadelphia, an arduous endeavor. They had to get up at the crack of dawn and did not get back home until late in the evening. I wondered when they studied. They were persistent and earned their degrees, which impressed me greatly. In my little boy's mind, though, I was afraid to go to college if the only option was a black college. I thought going to a black college to be a mighty hard thing. But I didn't know at the time that black folk getting an education in the United States has always had its moments of sheer physical hardship. In the mid-1960s, when my oldest sister was accepted at Temple University, a white state school, my family was very happy. It was considered a great breakthrough. Naturally, when it was time for me to go to college in 1970, I never thought about going to a black college. Everyone who advised me in high school was against that idea. I grew up in Philadelphia and used to ride past the University of Pennsylvania on a streetcar. I decided I wanted to go there because it was rich and white and thus had prestige. As a black boy trying to make it in a white society, I thought I needed all the prestige I could get. What made this easier was that white colleges had opened their doors and virtually every black kid I knew who was college-bound then was encouraged to go to one. When I was offered this chance to study Fisk University in Nashville as an institution, I realized that learning what a black college is like has deep personal meaning for me. What had I missed, and what had I avoided? What had I lost by not going to a black college, and what had I gained? What is missing from my identity because I never had this experience of black community? And what did I learn to make up for this lacking? Ultimately, the only way to know myself truly and to know black people is to understand how and why black community works and doesn't work. The nature of our society, Ralph Ellison said, is such that we are prevented from knowing who we are. This is especially true for black people. That is why black students come to Fisk these days. That is why I have come here. Every day I walk across the campus, I see the statue of W.E.B. Du Bois, Fisk's most famous alumnus, and think about his idea of double consciousness, that one is ever mindful of being two distinct beings, a black and an American, and they are largely unreconciled concepts. I think every black person is afflicted with this division, and I've come to Fisk to understand my own version of it. I've learned, as I've spent more time on the Fisk campus, that there is no hope that I'll ever resolve it.
Gerald Early teaches English and heads the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.